Hi, everybody from Wondery. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. When we think of ancient Egypt, the images that most immediately come to mind are associated with its elite. The pyramids, royal mummies, ornate hieroglyphs on the walls of opulent tombs, things associated with the highest ranks of society. But the elite made up only a tiny percentage of the people living in ancient Egypt at any given time. What about everybody else? What about the people who built those tombs or grew the food that kept everybody fed? What can we know about them? The answer is, well, a heck of a lot, thanks to new approaches and cutting-edge tools. Today's guest is doing some incredibly cool work on the common people of ancient Egypt. Anne Austin is assistant professor of anthropology and archaeology at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. She specializes in using human remains in conjunction with art and texts to better understand health and disease in ancient Egypt, focusing on the wonderful site of Deir el-Medina. And she has also done some really innovative work on ancient tattooing. Professor Austin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So what first got you interested in A, ancient Egypt, and B, bioarchaeology, health, and disease?
So I was really, really lucky growing up. My family loved history. They loved travel. And so when I was really young, my parents took me to Egypt along with my sister and a friend of hers and my grandma, my uncle. We had this crazy tour of Egypt. And at the time, my sister was fascinated with it. My mom was fascinated with it. And probably, you know, if your sibling likes something, you by default have to not like it. I assumed, you know, Egypt, whatever. We know everything, right? Because societally, we're so fascinated with Egypt that I just assumed it has been studied. And then when we went there and did this tour and had this amazing guide, this Egyptian woman who was so accommodating to my questions. And every time I had a question, I had all these questions about daily life that she couldn't answer. And she said, we just don't know. So I could ask about which king ruled when, and she could tell me off the top of her head. But when it was the things that I'm fascinated with, those things we didn't have answers. So that sparked my interest. The fact that we have a place we think we know so well, and yet, to be honest, there is still so much yet to learn. And from there, I got interested in bioarchaeology when I looked at how I could answer those kinds of questions about daily life and realized they're really hard to answer in many of the traditional ways we do archaeology. And when I looked at some of the work that really inspired me, it was by bioarchaeologists who were able to really bring people back into archaeology, quite literally, and bring them back to life through the kinds of descriptions and analyses and studies that they could do to tell those stories that haven't been told for so long.
Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. So I have a couple of follow-up questions, but the first one is, it seems like ancient Egypt would be a really natural place to pursue bioarchaeology, given just how many human remains we have, and also kind of the centrality of death and burial to ancient Egyptian society. Like, you would think that that's a really fertile field, but like, it doesn't feel like, in comparison with other places in the ancient world, there's actually been that much systematic bioarchaeological work. It seems like there's kind of a paradox there.
I agree. I think part of the reason is that Egypt was excavated a lot in the 1900s and just looted and excavated in the 1800s. And those excavations deprioritized the human remains. That's the nicest way to put it. In more aggressive ways, the archaeologists themselves were really aggressively looting Egypt, taking things out of the country. And if things didn't meet their needs, they got rid of them. So that's an issue. Just a little bit, right? That's an issue with bioarchaeology. It means that human remains were not valued at the site and many of the sites in Egypt. And it's only recently with people recognizing the field and its importance and recognizing the importance of valuing human remains that I've seen this huge shift. So now we have a lot of bioarchaeologists working in Egypt, but I think the next obstacle to overcome in Egyptology is really bridging the evidence. That's my focus, but many people who are trained in one field aren't trained in the other. So I'm really fortunate that I am trained both in Egyptology and bioarchaeology, but that's relatively rare. And so these conversations that are happening in many cases end up being completely separate, when in reality, we should be looking at all of this together because we have such amazing mountains of evidence.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit about that evidence. So you have human remains as a body of evidence that you can use, a literal body of evidence. And then you have this enormous corpus of texts, like more texts than any individual person could ever sift through to try to understand, you know, life in ancient Egypt. Do you feel like those different bodies of evidence tell the same story, different aspects of a story, or different stories entirely when it comes to trying to understand people's lives?
I think they're very good at complementing and complicating each other. I think they don't always tell the same story. So, for instance, in ancient Egypt, really there was a little bit of a taboo around talking about death. People in religious contexts don't talk about the death of the god Osiris. In personal contexts, I look at all these records, I have very few of them mention somebody dying, but we know all of those people died. So when we want to talk about what death looks like, we often can only approach it from the other end, about what happens after someone dies, and not from what happens before. And that's where bioarchaeology can really fit well with telling that story. The other side of things is that the stories that we learn from ancient Egypt that were written down by a very select group of people. They're written down predominantly by men of a certain age, of a certain status, and those people have their own experiences, but they can attest for everybody's. So bioarchaeology can offer a much more equitable distribution of information. We can look at the experiences of children, of the elderly, of the disabled, of women, and those experiences just don't appear as often in the texts. Conversely, though, you know, I look at skeletal evidence for health. I look at what happens when people get terrible fractures and traumatic injuries. But I can't tell you how many times somebody just got a cold, just got a minor illness, something that only affects the soft tissue or is only temporary. Those are major parts of our health experiences. And if you think about like your own health experiences, think about how often those actually should show up in bone. And the vast majority of times they just don't. So when we look at these texts, I can actually then supplement these big things like what caused people to die or what age they died at with these smaller things like how often were they sick in February, and really get a much more holistic picture of health.
I'm just thinking right now, I've got some raging cases of tendonitis that are making my life miserable. But like, that's if you were to look at my bones, even, you know, let's say I died tomorrow, God forbid, and somebody was looking at my bones afterward, like, you're not going to tell that I had like just raging pain in both of my elbows from looking at that. And yet that's a major component of, you know, how I'm feeling on a day-to-day basis. I just remember, you know, when I first started looking at bioarchaeology 10, 12 years ago, the idea that you could view human remains as a body of evidence to be read in, you know, in this, like by analogy, in the same way that you're reading a text, that you can read it along the grain, you could read it against the grain. There are different ways that you can mine it for information. But at the heart of all of that, you have a kind of a self-contained story of a person. I just remember thinking that was the coolest thing, one of the coolest things I had ever heard. I mean, one of the coolest approaches. And, you know, and the idea going along with that, that different cultures and different activities create the body, that that's not, the body is not a given, that that just struck me as such a fascinating thing. And it's striking to see it applied to ancient Egypt, to a place where, again, as you said, that we feel like we know so much about it. And yet all of a sudden, when you approach this different body of evidence, you might get much different answers about what was going on in people's lives.
Yeah. And you find completely new things. I mean, the tattoo evidence that we're getting, we have some visual possible depictions of tattoos. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more later, but even then, people might argue that it's henna or that it wasn't very common. And when you have human remains that display incredible amounts of tattoos and you have it in one person, you can start to tell that one person's story and see how that must extrapolate into something bigger. So I love the scalability of bioarchaeology that we have. It's so rare in archaeology to have the opportunity, or even history more broadly, to study a person, like really, really just one person. And we have that opportunity. And we also have the opportunity to study a population, to study a village, to study, you know, across periods in ways that are just usually not that easy to do when you're going this far back in time. So I love that aspect of bioarchaeology.
So I have two things I want to follow up on. I want to follow up on the individual aspect and I want to follow up on the population one, but individuals first. So This is a question I've asked a few different bioarchaeologists, and I've gotten different answers. When you're working with human remains, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about the subjects of your research? I mean, from your perspective, do you feel like you're dealing with a person? Is there an emotional connection, or do you kind of have to take a step back from that to be able to do your analysis?
Yeah, I can kind of see both. I work in tombs that have been heavily looted, and the tombs that I work in, when people looted, they just literally tore people apart looking for jewelry, reselling parts of bodies to tourists, sometimes just moving people to side so they could reuse the tomb. And this is looting that I know has been going on since the antiquity, because we have ancient Egyptian texts that talk about people going in tombs and taking things out and moving people around. So this is something that has been going on for a long time. And by the time I get into these tombs, you know, these people are in a terrible state. They're bones are all separated from each other. And so for me, it's really important to prioritize their humanity and think about their humanity. It's also hard to think about them as whole people because they literally aren't whole people, right? And so some of the things that we have to do in bioarchaeology, like we have to number all the elements that we're looking at in order to have consistent data and know where everything originated. That's really important. But then it does feel like we're turning a person into an object. So I always try to find ways to ensure I'm like reminding myself of the humanity of the people that I'm working with. Whether in publications, I've really moved, for instance, away from using mummy and toward mummified human remains, just because the word mummy has become this monstrous, inhumane thing. We literally, and we do this a lot in the US, we take dead people and we turn them into monsters. So you think about vampires, you think about zombies, you think about mummies, and it's my job to take them and put them back into being viewed as people. So I'm very, very cognizant of that. But realistically, I definitely see that there's this contradiction between when you're studying one bone of somebody's arm and then really humanizing them. I don't name individuals, just because I just imagine if someone named me and gave me a name I didn't like, I'd be mad. You know, you're like, that's my arch nemesis. Like, why did you name me Neferhotep? I hate that guy. So I don't talk about people by name. I know some people do. That's a way. So I think we all have to find our own ways of reminding ourselves of the humanity of the people that we're working with. And even if it's things that you might not think are particularly scientific, I think it's important. So I, for instance, like talk to them when I'm in the tomb. And I don't think that's strange. I think that makes sense. Yeah. So that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting answer, just because, as I mentioned, I've gotten different answers from different people. Like, I talked to a bioarchaeologist who had done stable isotope analysis on victims of human sacrifice in Shang, China. And she said it didn't really occur to her because what she was getting was the teeth. That's what she was working with. She was extracting her material and running her analysis. And she said it didn't really occur to her until very late in the process as she was writing up her results that, oh my God, like I'm dealing with people who like we've met these horrible ends. And she said it kind of hit her all at once. But that's got to be, I mean, but you're actually in the tombs. So that's giving you a different, like that's giving you a kind of a different connection to the person as opposed to just being in the lab or just being with kind of a fragment of the remains.
Right. Yeah. I'm in the tombs. We keep the human remains in the tombs because the tombs are the perfect place. Preservation there is going to be better than anywhere else. We've already gotten that tested through time, right? And that's where they wanted to be. So we want to keep them where they had intended to be to the extent that we know. I mean, like I said, this looting has happened for so long that I know in some examples, people were moved from one place to another, both by their own descendants and more recently by looters and archaeologists. But yeah, it's when you're in that space, I'm also on site. I'm right outside the village that they lived in. It's really intimately connected to their spaces. And I'm only in those spaces when I'm working with them. So for me, there is this kind of connection between the location and the people and the art that they leave on the walls and the artifacts that we've got an opportunity to study. So there's just a whole, all of it is still there, which I think really helps to, again, humanize.
Well, okay, so that's a really nice segue into talking about Deir al-Medina. So that's a place I've talked about in prior episodes. People, if you haven't listened to that one, it's a banger. I really enjoyed doing the research and writing that one. What do you think it is that's so interesting about this site? I mean, what is it to you? Like you mentioned the fact that you're in the place with the human remains, but what gives us such insight into the lives of the people who live there?
Yeah, this place is, I mean, we look at the ancient world and we say like the exemplar of the ancient world is Pompeii. And I am like, no, it's actually not. It's Deir al-Medina. I'm biased, of course, but I'll explain why I think that. And the first reason is that in Egypt, when you study cemetery in Egypt, generally the cemeteries are removed from the village that people are living in. So you can't look at a settlement and a cemetery at the same time in many, many places. This is an exception because the village of Deir al-Medina was built for the artisans to work on the royal tombs. So it was built further away from the Nile. It was built further away from regular everyday life. It was built near the tombs. And so consequently, their tombs are literally overlooking the village. It's almost like in a bowl. And there's tombs on either side from different periods of the use of the site. So we have the opportunity to look at the settlement and look at the tombs all together, which just in many places that's true. In Egypt, that's not as common. But what makes it stand out is that in antiquity, they dug this giant pit, which I'm sure you mentioned, 30 meters wide, 50 meters deep, filled it with all these daily life documents that were written on pieces of like sometimes papyrus that's preserved, but often limestone flakes or on pottery, both of which preserve really well. So we have this absolutely stunning record of text, and it's the kind of text that you do not intentionally leave behind. So when we find text in archaeology, it's often the stuff they want you to find, and we're finding the stuff that they wanted to bury. So if you go in my trash, you might find a pay stub, you might find a letter from a friend, you might find something I jotted down to remind myself. And that's the kind of things we're getting. So I can tell you all the drama. I know like examples of like, oh, this person is in a fight with this person because her husband was really upset. And then that person had an affair with that person. And I know their names. And so we get those kinds of juicy details that maybe wouldn't appear in most places. We also get these bureaucratic records from the site because it was built for that bureaucratic function. So since it was meant to build the royal tombs, there was a lot of accountability over time built into the site. And so they had to record when people weren't at work. They had to record how many pieces of wick they used when they were lighting the tomb. And that equated how many hours they were working in the tomb, because each wick lasted about an hour. They had to record the rations that they distributed. And so we have these amazing records that give us that depth of daily life, both in terms of these personal details and then this systematic bureaucracy that you just don't, it's like British bureaucracy level of things that you don't normally see. So those aspects make it so exceptional. And I think the last point I'll make is that these people are in a really weird and unique socioeconomic position. So they are the people who are doing the hard manual labor to cut and decorate these tombs. These tombs are not pyramids anymore. At this point in time, they're built into the rock. And so the actual work to cut the rock requires both skill, understanding the rock in this area. It can actually be very friable. You have to know where the other tombs are and not run into each other. But it's also just hard work. And even getting to the site is not easy because you have to climb up and down these Theban hills or mountains. And they're not, I've tried it. I climbed to the top using the modern stairs. There's over 1,000 stairs to get from the bottom to the top of where the Deir al-Medina village is, to the top of the cliffs you have to cross to get back into the royal tombs. So those types of things make this population seem more like a blue collar kind of labor force. Then if you look at on the other side, you look at the knowledge they have, you look at the amount of just quantity of objects they have, the quality of objects, their access to like bronze, all of those things put them in an elite position. So they are this weird group that is both kind of everyday folks and elite at the same time. And I wouldn't call them middle class because they in some ways encapsulate either side and not the middle. So that's what makes them great, because they kind of give us this glimpse that's a little more relatable than a lot of the other populations we'd be looking at, like kings and the really high elites that didn't have to work a day in their lives.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Physically, from the perspective of the human remains that you see, what can you tell about their daily lives? I mean, you mentioned that they're doing hard labor. In what ways is that reflected in their bodies?
We do see in their bodies, their rates of osteoarthritis in their lower limbs for the men within the village are higher than comparable populations that I was able to look at for data on those. When I looked at the women, I don't see that as frequently. So they have some rates of osteoarthritis more likely related to age. I couldn't prove that because of the commingling. But when I looked at the overall comparison of what we're seeing at Daryl Medina and other populations, the women's rates weren't significantly different. The men's, looking across the body, we see it appearing as having a much higher rates of osteoarthritis in the lower limb. And in some cases, we also have some evidence from the elbow. So those are the areas where I think you expect to find it based on the nature of their work. This process of getting to and from work was not, again, an easy hike. Even they had temporary shelters that they stayed at during the week, and they would leave from those and go down to the king's tomb and come up. And even then, that's basically the same as climbing up the Great Pyramid every day. So that has an impact on the skeleton for sure. And then the kind of labor to actually excavate out and carry around this amount, I mean, the amount of stone that they even have to carry is incredible. And so that likely could explain why we're seeing higher rates of osteoarthritis in the elbow as well.
That makes a lot of sense. If you have lots and lots of not just walking up and down, but also probably loaded carrying of things. So like you got to figure like they don't have enough pack animals to carry everything that needs to go back and forth. So you got to figure, oh, well, you're going, okay, carry 40 pounds worth of whatever it is on your hike. And the elbow one makes a ton of sense too, because not only just the digging out, but also if you're doing like finer work and just movement at that joint, that's going to put a lot of pressure on the elbow. I mean, I know at other sites, like at Akhetaten, the population that was excavated there had really high rates of back injuries. Was that also the case at Daryl Medina or not so much?
No. So what's fascinating is the stuff that you're seeing at Akhetaten. I mean, it's just, first of all, just crazy because it's happening to these very young individuals. Mm-hmm. So they have the kinds of back injuries that you'd expect from someone much older. They have things happening to their bodies that should not happen when they're teenagers. And so it suggests that there is definitely like intense use of a very young labor force at that place. We don't see that as much. So I do see some of the same kinds of changes in the spine. So we have degenerative changes in the spine, which happen even in our time. I mean, they happen as you age. Mm-hmm. We have some examples of compression fractures in the spine. That's things that could happen from a fall, for example. We just don't find, though, that degree of health issues when I compare the data that comes out of Amarna and the data that I'm producing. So when we look at things like traumatic injuries, there's just far less trauma at Daryl Medina than what we're seeing at Amarna. When I look even at these joint degeneration, when your joints break down, the tissue between them, the cartilage between them that protects them, breaks down as well. And at some point when that is gone, the bones rub against each other. And when bone rubs against bone, it polishes the other side and leaves a characteristic polishing we call eburnation. And we find lower rates of eburnation at Daryl Medina as well. So even when they're doing all of these regular things that increase their overall rates of osteoarthritis, we aren't seeing it get to the extreme point that I've seen in the data coming out of Amarna.
That's so fascinating for so many reasons, because, I mean, you figure there've got to be a lot of factors that go into why that would be the case, right? So, I mean, better diet, better working conditions, but also probably like institutional knowledge of how to do the jobs, which is something that you see, is generational passing down of occupations from person to person. If you know how to do something well, and your parents knew how to do it well, and your grandparents knew how to do it well, you're probably less likely to do it in a way that's going to screw up your body long term. You're probably going to end up with fewer of those injuries than somebody who's just like, well, okay, you're just in from the countryside. Why don't you haul some blocks around for us? Like, that's how you get yourself hurt, being exposed to massive new loads without being prepared for them. Like, you're much more likely to see traumatic injuries and really severe kind of rapid onsets of things.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, so right now I'm working on a book that's related to my dissertation, but really much bigger. And it's looking at health at the site and the ways that we can study it from both the skeletal side and the textual. And one of the focuses, or really the main focus of the book, is to understand how social determinants of health show up in the ancient world, because they're just very important when we talk about health in modern populations. And we've come to realize that so much of our health is not determined just by our access to healthcare and medicine and the kinds of medicine we produce, but also by these social determinants that can include things like how much social support you have. What does that social support look like? And so looking at this site, we do have a population that by the time it's been there for a couple hundred years is very well established, that has intergenerational knowledge, intergenerational wealth, and they use those things to take care of themselves. They use those things, they rely on those things to improve their own health. So I think that's a great example of something that could be the case, that they're using that intergenerational knowledge to improve their health by making sure they understand how best to do the job, how best to, like, they've figured out the best route to leave the village. They've figured out all of these ways to ensure that whatever their responsibilities are, they can maximize it.
Yeah. Oh, your elbow's hurting. Here's a nice little poultice that you can put on that. Or we'll make you a little sling or a brace to take some pressure off the joint. Something like stuff like that. Like because I know you have a background in sports. Like you fenced, right? And you know that if you spend enough time around people who have been around a sport, then you've got little tricks, you've got little tips. And that's true if you work a blue collar job too. Like somebody who's done the job tells you, like, yeah, no, you don't want to hold it that way, because if you hold it that way, you're not going to feel it now, but in 3 weeks, your wrist is going to be killing you.
Yeah, and great point.
Yeah. And stuff like that. I mean, just like you can't overstate the amount of kind of knowledge that gets passed down informally that has an effect on your bodily health. And, you know, in a white collar world of workers, that's not necessarily something that you think about all the time, because, you know, how often are you thinking about, like, well, don't type that way, type the other way. But when your job is physical and it's tied to your body, like the stuff like that matters a lot more. And you don't necessarily think about a blue collar workplace as somewhere where there's being a lot of kind of explicit knowledge being passed around.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, in these cases, we know they're able to not only pass around knowledge, also record it, because they are extremely literate. So the fact that this population can not only pass it down orally, but also really keep it up across generations. And we have examples of families keeping medical archives, for example, where they have a medical text and they expand it, have a son adds a little and grandson adds a little. And that process is going to keep the knowledge going for generations.
So I want to follow up on something you just said. You were talking about being able to meld different kinds of evidence to tell a story, and that's something you're going to do in your book. A few years ago, you wrote one of my very favorite pieces that I've ever run across in my research on the ancient world about accounting for sick days at Daryl Medina. So there were a whole bunch of reasons why this was fascinating, but especially because in the skeletal record, you almost never see short-term illnesses, just the kind of stuff that keeps people out of work. How were you able to find those? How were you able to talk about those?
Yeah, well, we have these bureaucratic records at Darrow Medina, and one of the kinds of records that they had to keep, the scribe recorded every day someone was out sick or just absent from work. And all of those absences have the date, have the name of the person, and the reason they were absent. Sometimes the reason is just like, they weren't there. You know, they don't give you much detail. But whenever people were sick, they left the Egyptian word mer, sick, to tell us they were sick. Rarely they would tell us why they were sick. Sometimes it would be like something related to an injury, probably at work, like we were discussing. So somebody burned their hand. We have an example, couple examples of that. Somebody hurt their leg. We have a couple examples of that. But also there's some really interesting ones. Like one person was sick because they were too drunk the night before and they were beaten being too drunk. So beaten and a hangover, it's a pretty good reason, I guess, to be out from work. So yeah, we have these records and I was able to look at them over a pretty big chunk of history of the site. And probably the hardest part was adjust their dates to meet our calendar dates. That was extra complicated because the ancient Egyptian calendar is 365 days, which is great, but they don't have that extra quarter day. So those leap years add up. When you don't have that a leap year built into your calendar over several hundred years, your dates start to shift. So I was able to readjust their dates, get them based on our system. And what was really interesting is I saw how those changed over the year. And they really do have, just like we do, a seasonality of illness, a period of time where it's just more likely that people are out sick rather than absent for other reasons. And when you look at what that period looks like in other examples talking about seasonality of illness from this region of Egypt, we see, for instance, much later in the Greco-Roman period, similar things. People are dying around that time of year more frequently than in other times of year because we have tags on the mummified human remains from those that period that write down in Demotic the date that they died. So we actually have great data on that. Additionally, when you go even later and you look at European explorations of Egypt and they're recording the kinds of diseases they're encountering, what we see is this early spring period where things get a lot worse is actually the time where we just have all of the diseases coming out at once. So it's not that one disease seems to be driving this. It's that all the diseases that are going to be active tend to start to grow and be active that are overlapping during that time. And so it's pretty amazing that we can track seasonality of illness and relate it to other factors in this one region of Egypt, not just during my period of the New Kingdom, but then multiple periods, thousands of years later too.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
How did people deal with illness at Deir el-Medina? So they're sick, they're not going to work. I mean, how long could you get away with staying off the job?
That's a good question. We have examples of people. We have one example of a text where a guy is out of work for months and seems to get in trouble. But it's fascinating that he was able to be away from work for that long. I don't have the individual absences from that time, unfortunately. So it's hard to tell, was he really out every single day for that period or did he like go back and forth? I do have an example of this one workman, Mary Sekhmet, who went to work, was sick, took a couple days off, tried to go back to work, was still really too sick, went home, spent some more time getting better, and then returned to work. So in that one person's example, it's kind of fascinating to see that there was something compelling him to go back to work. And why that's surprising is that we know that they were paid just based on being on the roster, not based on the number of days they worked. So we have their rations. We see that their rations don't change in reference to their absences. And so there's other pressures going on. I've got this one letter from somebody saying, hey, will you send someone to help our side catch up because my brother's out sick and we need somebody to take over his job. And so that's a really good example where you can see some of the pressure going on. When the Egyptians built tombs, they had two sides, one working on the left, one working on the right. And so if one side gets further ahead and the vizier comes to do an inspection, they're going to notice and potentially penalize the other side that hasn't caught up yet. So there are these accountability mechanisms that probably played a role in what it meant to be out sick from work. But the fact that they were given paid leave, the fact that they had a person designated as their physician who was one of the other workmen, but he was able to take time off to take care of his colleagues, to take care of their families. That says something about the investment in making sure these people are healthy enough to do their job. Do I think the Egyptian state's like some benevolent state that cares about people? No, I don't think that's the case. But I do think they are going to provide the resources to this group of people because they're hard to replace. Mm-hmm. The people in Amarna are easy to replace. We're going to take that 12-year-old and get another one from the countryside. These people who are learning their craft from their fathers, who learned it from their grandfathers, who learned it from their great-grandfathers, they are not replaceable. And so the Egyptian state, when it can, is providing these resources so that they can finish the tomb the way that the king wants it to be done.
I think that's a really fascinating example of how you can use Deir al-Medina profitably, like as kind of an anchor point to talk about the rest of ancient Egypt, is like we're just talking about the ways in which it is and isn't typical. So you are seeing rates of some traumatic injuries, you're seeing degenerative diseases that are associated with people who are working hard, but you're also seeing the ways in which this is dramatically unlike other places in that the workers seem to be valued, they seem to be secure in their jobs, they can take time off if they're sick. Like, it's hard to imagine, having read through the reports from the cemetery at Amarna, like that those people couldn't have, it doesn't seem like they could have taken a day off. Like, if they were going to take a day off, they weren't going to eat. And that's exactly how you end up with terrible population health of the kind that you see at that site.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that at Deir al-Medina, when the state starts to collapse and the state is losing its power to get resources, it's less reliable. They're not giving the workmen at Deir al-Medina their rations on time. They just go on strike. Like, they're just like, well, we aren't going to work then. I mean, who in the ancient world had the power to go on strike? And I think that really is a testament to both their community in terms of their overall view, but the state's, their connection with the state, but also their ability, they're smart to work together, right? They know how to work together as a community. They write, there are these wisdom texts from ancient Egypt more broadly. It's a type of text that exists, and it's usually written like from a father to son to say, here's what you need to know about the world. I'm going to give you this wisdom. I'm going to instruct you in the ways of the world. And at Deir al-Medina, they love these. We have lots of examples of these wisdom texts, and they even wrote their own. So we have a couple that come from the village, and there are things in there that show how they valued community. They say, take care of your neighbor because tomorrow when you need it, they will take care of you. So I think that that's one of the things that's coming out for me in the book is just the degree to which they worked cohesively as a community. And because they were a little more remote, because they was clearly identified and walled, you knew who was in it and you knew who was out. Because there are these clear lines that tell you who's part of this, whose family was part of it. They have a kind of solidarity that might not be achievable in a place like Amarna because it just was such a short run site and they don't have that family history. And because of that, they don't have the same ability to generate community.
Yeah, it makes me wonder how much of that is generalizable. Like, because maybe Amarna is the case that's actually the real outlier here, right? In terms of drawing in people from all over the place for an intense short-term project. I mean, you are almost intentionally breaking the bonds of community that are holding people in a certain place in order to get that workforce, right? So as unusual as the people of Deir al-Medina might be in terms of their relationship to the state, in terms of, you know, getting paid regular wages, all of this, I mean, their ability to work outside for extra wages, as unusual as they may be in that sense, they may be much more typical in terms of their kind of local solidarity and their connection to the place that they're living in and their, you know, the fact that their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents have all lived in this place and kind of the way that they interact with each other, that may actually be more representative than what we see elsewhere.
I think it's a great point, especially when you're thinking about the bigger population of Egypt, the farmers of Egypt, the people who might not be moving as much because they have to stay located near where they farm, near where they're having their crops. Aside from the seasons where it's easier to move around, there's a lot of the year where you're really stuck with your community. So I think that's also, I think it was an intentional move in the Amarna period to pull people out from that structure so they wouldn't have the support they needed. I would be excited to see if things go in that direction as their research continues, but it's something that I see not just at Amarna, but if you think about some of these other major building projects, major state projects in Egypt, they often require that you're taking people away from their communities and putting them in a new place. And that's what happened at Darul Madinah at first, but they just had the time to develop into something bigger.
Well, I mean, I think looking outside of Egypt, there are a lot of parallels for the kind of trauma and patterns of, you know, repetitive stress that you see at Amarna. Like when you have a population that's being put to work to build something and they may not necessarily want to be there and they're being plucked from where they come from, I think you're much more likely to see a population that doesn't look good. They've been, I mean, brutalized is not a too strong a word to use. I mean, you see it in Shang China, you see it in the classical period, in excavations from the city of Rome. Like those people were in bad shape. Yeah, there's an argument to be made about what doing that kind of monumental building does to the people who do it, if you're going to do it on that scale and with that speed. I want to shift gears just a little bit and ask you about tattooing, because this is something you've been working on a lot recently. It's fascinating. I've had guests on to talk about ancient tattooing before. How prevalent do you think this was in ancient Egypt?
That's a great question. It's very hard to answer. I'll say it's more prevalent than we currently think is my hunch. Because it is so hard to find. So getting evidence for tattooing is just, I'm really fortunate because I'm working in a place where people, their skin is still preserved. So step one, that's very difficult. I'm also, if not fortunate for them, but for studying tattooing, because of the looting that was happening at the site, I never unwrap people. I leave everybody as intact as I find them. But if I find somebody who's been unwrapped and their skin is preserved, I can actually check for tattoos. If you look in museum collections, that's not the case, right? People aren't, you can't check. So we don't know in museums whether or not people were tattooed in many cases. There's a couple examples where we do, and it's the pre-dynastic before they started wrapping people. So it seems just too coincidental that the places where we happen to have preserved skin, we happen to find tattoos, and the places where we don't have preserved skin or we can't look at it because their skin is covered, we don't find it. Like there are definitely some tattoos hidden somewhere that we are not finding. And it makes me wonder, when I look at this site, I now every season for the last couple of years have found more tattoos. So it is not a one and done thing. There are definitely more women. This is a case where all the individuals so far are all women. There are more women tattooed than I think I had assumed. I think many other people had assumed. And as we look at it across time, the evidence we have for tattooing is really sparse and unevenly distributed. So it's hard for us to know if that uneven, sparse distribution is because tattooing ebbed and waned in popularity, because the evidence for tattooing is harder to find in those periods that aren't represented. Or if it's because we're studying very specific places where tattooing is practiced and in other parts of Egypt, it wasn't. I wish I had the right answer to know more, but that's because it's such a new field. I mean, if you look at the amount of evidence we have around tattoos in ancient Egypt, in terms of human remains, there's just three women that were found with tattoos before the 2000s, even before 2010, really. And it's only been since then that we've started to find evidence. Now we have more individuals. I'm finding more individuals. If you look at the total number of individuals that we have at Darul Madinah, it's not a huge number. It's like 6 or 7, depending on if some elements are the same individual or not. But that number is like half the tattooed people we have from ancient Egypt. So in that sense, it's a huge number. And I think it's only going to keep growing. So I think the answer is just that we will find more evidence for tattooing. It's more prevalent than we realize, but to the extent we're not going to know until we have more people looking.
It's fascinating because as you get a larger body of evidence to work with, like, you're going to be able to ask different questions about, you know, what did this mean? What were they for? How were practices changing over time? So I just did a few episodes on the Austronesian expansion and the Pacific. And so when you look at tattooing in that context, it does seem to be an ancestral practice that goes all the way back to Taiwan, but it also changes at various points in these Austronesian migrations, right? So, like, there are already tattooing practices that exist in the Bismarck Islands and around New Guinea. And one group of Austronesian migrants seems to pick up their method of tattooing from that group. So they already knew how to tattoo, but they changed the way that they did it when they came into contact with another group. So that allows you to ask really interesting questions about how are different people interacting with each other? You know, how are the meanings of these things changing? So even if the practice is constant, the way it's being done and the way it means for the people may not necessarily be. And as you get more data, you should be able to, you can kind of pose those questions. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the areas that we've seen is we have evidence of tattooing in ancient Nubia. And the question for a long time was whether any of the tattooing we see in Egypt was actually Egyptian, or was it people coming from Nubia? Was it people bringing Nubian practices into Egypt? And so now that we're getting more evidence, we can start to actually look at that more. And from everything I've seen so far, I'd argue that we do see some evidence that some of these are really Nubian traditions that we're finding in Egypt. But some of the stuff that we're getting from Daryl Medina is very local. So whether or not they got really into tattooing at Daryl Medina because they had saw some people with tattoos that were either of Nubian descent or maybe had connected with folks that were Nubian and learned that tradition at some point. And then they got into Daryl Medina and they're like, this is awesome. We're going to make our own thing. Maybe that's the case. I'm not sure. Or maybe that had happened hundreds of years earlier. And we just don't have the evidence that connects what happened during the Middle Kingdom with the New Kingdom, which is entirely possible. But something's going on there where we definitely have cultural connections between Egypt and Nubia, but we also have independent innovation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the fact that you can even ask those questions, that you can even pose them, is incredible. Just thinking about kind of the difference between doing archaeology now and doing it 100 years ago, I mean, the kinds of questions that you can ask and the kinds of insights that you can gain into societies are dramatically different. And so, I mean, I've taken up a ton of your time. I just have one more question for you. So we talked about tattooing, the kinds of questions you can ask there. As you're thinking about your career and things you want to work on and things that are possible to do in your field more generally, well, I mean, what's most exciting to you? Like, where do you find your attention being drawn?
Oh my gosh, so many places. It's not a fair question to ask, right? I think, so again, my main goal as a scholar is really to bridge these fields of Egyptology and bioarchaeology. And the more opportunities I've had to do that, the more exciting the inferences are. So I think to really dive into that as deeply as I can, that's my goal as a scholar. It has been, it's going to continue to be. And when you think about the number of opportunities that creates, it's really just astounding. So not only, for instance, I have an article that's coming out soon that's not only about tattooing that I'm finding in human remains, but that my colleague who works with me at Daryl Medina is finding in the figurines there. So we can start to ask questions about, are these tattoos? Why do they relate? What do the figurines mean? Like, how do they perceive tattoos on figurines and on people? It's just fun and fascinating. And we can do more with things like, in the US, we have this huge debate around when somebody becomes a person. Mm-hmm. When is a baby, that kind of question. Well, in the ancient world, that's different for each culture. When they name an individual is different. When they choose to give them objects, when they bury them a certain way, like they bury their adults, those are all different. Those are questions that we're now starting to be able to address at Daryl Medina with some of the evidence we're finding. So I think when you think about the kinds of things you can learn when you start to bridge these fields, it extends not only the possibility within Egypt, but even thinking about these bigger philosophical questions. It's just so fun. So that's kind of my answer to that question.
That's a great answer. I mean, and I really look forward to reading your book when it comes out. I look forward to all of your work because, again, like I said, the stuff of yours that I read is some of my favorite stuff that I've run across in all of the research I've done on the ancient world. I mean, there's a humanity to the way that you approach these people that I just thought was really, really striking and really interesting. And it's not something that I feel like you get to see all that often in these fields. So I just wanted to thank you again for your time and thank you for your work. It's an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at @Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.